tribes. I'm Tsimshian, Haida, and Nez Perce, so a lot of my inspiration comes from the art styles of my tribes, as well as my family, surroundings, environment, friends.
And could you tell me a little bit more about what mediums of art that you specialize in?
Yeah, so mainly I draw and I paint. I do a lot of traditional drawing, but I also do digital drawing as well, too, so working with Procreate on my iPad. And then I also do painting, mainly acrylic, but I have done watercolor here and there.
How will this opportunity expand not only your work as an artist, but sort of expand the celebration of Indigenous people and Indigenous art?
What I'm hoping for, being the artist for this year's Folkfest, is that my art gets started to seen more widely throughout Alaska, I suppose. I will say it's not my most obviously Indigenous design. I will say all of my art inherently becomes Indigenous because I am Indigenous, but at the same time, there's no form line in it. There's no traditional Native art in it for this design, but I still hope that means that people look into even my own art and see more of what I do, and that people just explore more of it.
That was Hunter Morrison and Savannah LeCornu. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Thanks so much for tuning in with us here on the KBOO Evening News on this Thursday, March 26, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Isabel Charlet, producer Annette Newell, our engineer Otto, and our director of evening news, Althea Billings. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. So if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, text KBOO to 44321. And stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Critics of artificial intelligence recently marched and rallied in a Stop the AI Race protest in San Francisco. They're demanding that major AI lab CEOs Sam Altman, Elon Musk, and Dario Amodei publicly commit to a conditional global pause on frontier AI development if labs all over the world do the same. David Kruger is a professor of artificial intelligence at the University of Montreal and the CEO of Evitable, a nonprofit devoted to providing information to the public about AI. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Kruger about the need for an AI pause.
So you're taking a tour of AI companies and you're protesting against them and you're trying to raise public awareness about what they're doing. Is that the idea?
Yeah, it's not just raising public awareness, although that's definitely one of the objectives. We are calling on the CEOs of these companies to agree to pause further progress to developing more powerful AI and superintelligence, conditional on other leading companies agreeing to such a thing. We think this is I think this is sort of a bare minimum commitment that anybody should be willing to make and should have already made by now.
And you have to go to all of the CEOs because you don't want to put them in a position where they'll feel like their competition is outpacing them? Is that the idea?
Well, we're not going to all of them. We're going to three of them today. Demis Hassabis, the CEO of DeepMind, which admittedly is part of Google, earlier this year said that he would like a conditional pause. And CEOs of the other companies have said things that would sure make you think they would like it. I think a common thing that people say is like, well, it'd be nice, but you know, we can't. It's just not possible. If we stop, you know, other people won't stop. So we want them to be very clear that they want to stop and that they're willing to cooperate with efforts to stop it, including efforts by the government or by third parties. I also would ask the companies to start putting their money where their mouth is then as well and start trying to stop it instead of racing to develop it more quickly.
So they might say, well, we'd like to, but it'll hurt our bottom line too much. And we have shareholders, we have investors, we have to please them. Would you expect them to say that?
I don't know. I think
I don't know if they're all publicly traded. I'm kind of assuming they are.
Yeah, they're not. So OpenAI and Anthropic, neither of those companies is publicly traded. I don't think XAI is either, although I'm not confident in that. But Anthropic and OpenAI are, I don't know if it's rumored or confirmed that they would be having IPOs later this year. But, you know, shareholders don't stand to benefit from a technology that kills everyone. Nobody stands to benefit from that technology.
Do you, as you go around in your daily life, run into people who say, my phone just went crazy on me, or my computer started doing things without my knowledge, and how could they get away with this? That kind of thing. It's sort of like the, I don't know if it's all AI, but this idea that corporations are basically running your life and you don't have any control over it. Is that sort of one of the core issues that motivates people to try to do something about AI?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I'm sure that's a motivation for some people. I mean, generally, I think the idea that these companies have too much power, you know, I think most people feel that way at this point. And especially as they become more consequential, you know, for things like where people get their news, or now even people's like emotional support, or you know, people having relationships with AIs. And that's just, you know, the tip of the iceberg. I mean, the next step is them basically taking everyone's jobs and being further integrated into government decision making, including, you know, mass surveillance and autonomous weapons. So I think there's a general impression that, you know, tech companies have too much power and they're getting more powerful all the time, and that's a threat to our society, to our democracy, and really to our future and our species.
And is it like other kind of high tech issues where Congress just is way behind and has no idea what's happening with this industry, and that they really need to put some regulations on it, but they don't quite know what to do?
I think something like that is the case. I'm actually planning to visit DC pretty soon, like in a couple of weeks or so. And I'll be really interested to talk to some policymakers and see where they're at with this, because I do think things are changing quickly. People are starting to realize, you know, just how big a deal this is. And I think a lot of people have moved on from asking, like, is this real, to like, what do we do about it? And I think, you know, regulations that have been proposed so far are just completely inadequate. We really don't know how to regulate this technology. The only thing that we can do that would be responsible and reduce the risk to an acceptable level right now would be to coordinate a global pause. And so we urgently need to work towards that.
Have you personally, or anyone in your group, spoken to the leaders of these companies?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know about the other people in the group. I've spoken to Dario a few times in the past. You know, I know a lot of people who have spoken to these people. You know, I made the conscious decision not to go work at a company, you know, much earlier in my career, because I didn't believe that, you know, that was the right way to have an impact, and I didn't trust the companies, and I didn't want to be beholden to their interests, and, you know, not allowed to say things that don't fit within their sort of PR interests and guidelines. But I know a lot of friends and a lot of people in my life have. And so, you know, I'm like close to one degree away from all of them, I would say.
And then there are people who say AI is great. It helps me do all this stuff, and it has so much potential, and we can't just pause it or stop it. It just has too much potential for helping society deal with problems. Do you run into that much?
Yeah, I do. I think that's something that's very common, especially, you know, in the tech world itself. And I think, you know, there's obviously some great things about AI. There's also some terrible things about it, you know, in its current form, in the ways that it's being used right now. But, you know, I'm really concerned about where this technology is headed in the very near future, you know, this year, the next couple of years. And I think that's the most important conversation to be having. And, you know, when we talk about pausing or stopping AI, what I personally want to see is an indefinite pause, so that we have enough time to figure out how to control the technology and how to, you know, make sure that we're making choices about if and how and when and whether and why to proceed with various forms of AI technology in a way that is actually beneficial to people and, you know, legitimate. And so that doesn't mean, you know, like, long story short, you know, if you're worried about not getting the benefits of AI, we can get them a bit later and not run the risk of all being killed or losing our power, and having our society completely disrupted or destroyed, losing our jobs, etc. So I personally don't feel like there's a huge rush here. And I think it would be really, foolhardy and kind of short-sighted of us to take the kind of gamble that is being, presented to us, and really taken on our behalf by these AI companies, instead of waiting and giving ourselves more time to do it more carefully if we choose to.
Have you seen much progress on the issue in other countries?
Yeah. So actually, earlier this year, I was testifying before Parliament for two different parliamentary committees in Canada, and I felt like that went very well, and it seemed like people were quite interested in the issue and understanding and grappling with some of the really important parts of it. I know there's been a lot of progress within the UK as well. So as a professor there at the University of Cambridge before I took my position at the University of Montreal, and I was there working with the UK government for a little bit in 2023 at the first government agency devoted to this issue. Unfortunately, I think no government is doing enough yet, but I do know that UK parliamentarians have signed a statement put out by this group, Control AI, expressing, their concern around the issue. And, I think we're seeing sort of progress everywhere at different paces, at different rates. And this is a trend I've been seeing the entire time I've been in the field over the last 15 years, roughly, but it's just not happening fast enough. So I'm now taking leave from my academic job to focus on accelerating that and helping people understand the issue and what they can do about it.
You mentioned just the UK, but in Canada are a little ahead of the US, but that's kind of typical when it comes to regulation of just about everything, I think.
Yeah, well, there's more regulation in Europe. There's actually more regulation in China as well. I don't know, if these countries are ahead in terms of understanding the potential impact of the technology. So it's a little bit unclear what's happening with the U.S. government right now. I think some people in the government don't really understand how big a deal this is, that it's not just going to be like a big moneymaker, but it's going to really, destroy the world, or at least very likely to. And I think other people, kind of don't care or are willing to take that gamble, or think that, the New World Order is going to be one that's very good for them personally and their allies. And so they're happy to, screw over everyone else and don't really care if normal people can even continue to have a job, so they can continue to put food on their table and so on.
Do you get the impression that many people are not concerned with the issue at all because they just don't know much about it, or it doesn't seem like anything that would affect their particular job?
Yeah, I think that's changing. But I think there's actually some research showing that historically, while people are very concerned about AI, when you ask them, the political saliency of the issue is low. So it's not something that they think about that often, especially when they're thinking about politics. But, it's rapidly rising. So the most recent study shows that the political salience of AI is rising faster than anything else. And, I think when I talk to people, I think they are concerned. And I think one thing that's really important is for people to talk about this more, because, it sounds weird. And I think a lot of people feel like they're alone in their concerns because we aren't having the public conversation about it that we should be, that we need to be. And so much of the narrative is dominated by what I really view as sort of less important topics or distractions, like even, at the level of kind of the boardroom drama of like, what just happened at like this company, you've hired this person or fired this person or something. I see so many news articles about that, and I'm like, I don't give a shit. All these people are working on this technology that is going to kill everyone. Why aren't we talking about that?
Anything else you want to add to what you said?
No, I mean, I'm really looking forward to this protest tomorrow at noon. So we'll be at Anthropic, OpenAI, and XAI. I think it's going to be the largest protest of its kind in the history of the U.S. So there was another quite large one in London recently. And I think, this year I'm really expecting AI to become a much bigger issue, because I think people are increasingly catching on to just how crazy the situation is and how little is being done to protect them and their friends and family and loved ones.
And I guess war making is a big issue, kind of a sub issue, how much destruction can AI cause? Do you get that a lot from people?
Definitely some. You know, historically, when I think back to, you know, like 10 years ago or whatever in the field, when I was talking to people about AI and the issues with AI, you know, one thing is that people were really skeptical that AI would get so powerful so fast. And so I think they've been proven wrong on that point for sure. But they were also very skeptical that AI would show the kind of signs we've seen of, you know, going rogue and losing control over it. And I would always say, well, you know, like people would tell me, I'm not going to be worried until we see, like, you know, robots with guns marching in the streets. And I was like, well, that's where this is headed. You know, if we don't do something to stop it, that will be where this will ultimately end up. And I think people were really skeptical about that because nobody in the field that I talked to wanted to see AI developed for use in the military. That was just widely viewed as something that was really dangerous and not what we wanted and not what got anybody into the field. And so a lot of people, you know, in the past when I was an intern at DeepMind, there was a lot of internal discussion about Project Maven, a lot of resistance to that, you know, much, much more minor foray into dealing with the military at that time. And I think now that we're seeing these companies really, you know, going into it full throttle, so to speak, I'm disappointed that more of my colleagues haven't stepped up to really, you know, to do something about that, to protest or to quit. And I do think it's a hard problem to solve, like all the other AI problems. The problem underlying all of this is AI getting more powerful. And so we really need, you know, an international agreement to stop making more powerful AI. And that's the solution that I see here. And I think we can do it. A lot of people think it's inevitable. We can't stop it. There's nothing we can do. But that's one of the main purposes of my organization, Inevitable, is to show that, you know, no, there is a solution. If we have to, we can get rid of the AI chips and the factories that make them. And that's a very simple and robust way to stop AI progress. And we could monitor that and enforce that. And we could start working on that today if we had the political will. So I think that's what we should be doing, unless or until somebody has a better plan. Because at the end of the day, governments are going to need to be confident that their adversaries aren't building super intelligent AI in secret. And any plan that doesn't give them that confidence, I don't think is going to work. So that's kind of the thing that I think, you know, the answer to the, like, what about China question in my mind is, you know, we have to go hard on this, and we have to find a really robust solution, and we don't have long to do it. So let's get to work.
Yeah, it seems like some people are so enamored with the technology and what it can do that they don't really take ethical concerns all that seriously. So it's just more of a technical mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I'd like to do, just from the point of view of raising public awareness, is to compile just a list or a video of all of the incredibly, like, shockingly antisocial, anti-human things that people working on this technology have said in public. It's really eye-opening how many people are really, you know, just eager for AI to take over, or think that, you know, they don't care. They're really just in it, you know, to get rich, and they don't care if it has a risk of killing everyone. You know, people just say these things. And these are, you know, a decent chunk of the people working to build this technology have these kinds of completely unconscionable views.
That was University of Montreal AI professor David Kruger speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Is Trump looking for an off-ramp from the war? Any answer is correct. U.S. intelligence contradicts Trump's war rationale, and fallout from the postponed U.S.-China summit. First, is Trump looking for an off-ramp from the war? Based upon what President Trump is saying and doing lately, the answer is yes and no. Consider what he said in a social media post last week. We are getting very close to meeting our objectives as we consider winding down our great military efforts in the Middle East. That's hardly a commitment to exiting, but it was enough to generate speculation that Trump was finally ready to declare victory and withdraw. The serious damage to Middle East allies by Iranian retaliation, the increasing U.S. casualties, the fast-rising U.S. gas prices, and the failure to open up the Strait of Hormuz, all these developments fly in the face of Trump's expectation of an easy win. But facts don't often move Trump. He probably also considers that he hasn't achieved any of his ever-shifting objectives. Regime change in Iran, its leadership's unconditional surrender, the total elimination of its nuclear capability, and Iran's support of terrorism. In the face of these conflicting circumstances, Trump seems to be burning the candle at both ends. To sustain his war policy, he ordered another 4,500 Marines to the Middle East and threatened to obliterate Iran's power grid, starting with the biggest one first, he said, if it doesn't open the strait. The biggest facility is a nuclear power plant. Destroying it might cause an environmental catastrophe. It probably would also be a war crime. Iran responded immediately to that threat, with one official saying Iran would, quote, irreversibly destroy energy facilities in the region if the U.S. attacked its power plants, and another official warned that Iran would completely close the Strait of Hormuz. Meantime, Iran's missiles have struck two cities close to Israel's nuclear weapon base in the Negev Desert. Then on Monday, Trump withdrew the threat to the power grid. In a social media post, he cited, quote, very good and productive conversations regarding a complete and total resolution of our hostilities in the Middle East. Based on the tenor and tone of these in-depth, detailed, and constructive conversations, which will continue throughout the week, he postponed any and all military strikes against Iranian power plants and energy infrastructure for 5 days, claiming there were, quote, major points of agreement with Iran. Pressed for details, Trump said he has sent Iran a 15-point plan and that Iran has agreed not to have a nuclear weapon or engage in any form of uranium enrichment. That is surely not true. Iran says this is all fake news. Iran is not denying that exchanges with the U.S. are taking place through various Middle East intermediaries, but its foreign ministry said Trump's real intention is to, quote, reduce energy prices and buy time for implementing his war plans. The minister may be right. Oil prices did come down, though only to $100 a barrel, and those 5 days are just enough for the stock market to rally. Playing the market is just what one would expect from Trump and his two envoys, Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, both of whom have major investments in the Middle East. Israel's objectives in the war are not the same as Trump's. The Netanyahu government has made clear that it is determined to eliminate Iran's leadership and its nuclear capability, no matter what the Americans decide. Israel has not stopped military operations in Iran or Lebanon. The peace that Trump's plan was supposed to bring to Israel with Hamas's defeat is gone, replaced by rampant settler violence in the West Bank. Will Trump leave the battlefield to Israel in any agreement with Iran? That would surely anger the Saudis, Qataris, and the Emirates, and provide fertile new ground for Hamas and Hezbollah to recruit for a new round of warfare. And then there are the U.S. allies on whom Trump did not think he had to rely. But with the Strait of Hormuz effectively blocked, he's forced to demand that NATO reopen the strait. So far, he's gotten nowhere. Italy, Germany, and France have indicated that they will help ensure safe passage in the strait only after a ceasefire. Trump is having to resort to steps that don't come close to easing the energy situation, such as removing sanctions on Russian and Iranian oil shipments at sea, a bizarre case of enriching one's adversaries in wartime. The bottom line: Trump has made war over matters that were settled in peacetime, a strait open to all international traffic, an Iran that was nowhere near having a nuclear bomb, and thousands of people who would otherwise be alive. Only personal pique and Israeli pressure can explain his decision to attack Iran. And on the subject of an Iranian nuclear weapon, the next story: U.S. intelligence contradicts Trump's war rationale. Top U.S. intelligence officials directly contradicted one of the Trump administration's justifications for going to war, repeating the intelligence community's conclusion that Iran was years away from developing missiles capable of hitting the U.S. In testimony before a Senate committee, Tulsi Gabbard affirmed the conclusion reached by the Trump administration's Defense Intelligence Agency last year that it would be a decade before Iran could get past the technological hurdles to produce weapons capable of reaching the United States. Likewise, CIA Director John Ratcliffe did not give a timeline when asked whether Iran would have been able to strike the United States within 6 months, instead focusing on its ability to reach as far as Europe and threaten U.S. bases and interests in the region. Nevertheless, Trump continues to lie about Iran's capabilities, claiming, for example, in his State of the Union address, that Iran was, quote, working to build missiles that will soon reach the U.S. of A. That claim goes along with his insistence that Iran was only 2 weeks away from having a nuclear weapon when the U.S. struck Iran. Fallout from the postponed U.S.-China summit. A consensus among China watchers seems to be that China will be the beneficiary of Trump's postponement of the summit that had been scheduled for March 30 through April 2. Trump was already weakened by the Supreme Court's invalidation of his tariffs. The Iran war's length and absence of a clear success only add to Trump's problems. When a summit will take place is uncertain, but even when it was scheduled, the agenda had not been set and other details remained undetermined. Wu Xinbo, a senior China watcher with Fudan University in Shanghai, thinks that, quote, delaying the visit a bit would give both sides more time to negotiate and prepare, which could lead to a better outcome for the visit. But Trump's agenda is already full with the Iran war, Cuba, and relations with Israel. It could be some time before a U.S.-China summit is again being planned. In other news, Hungary's dispute with Ukraine may be settled. Hungary's Viktor Orbán had contended that until Ukraine reopened a pipeline that carries Russian oil through Ukraine to Hungary, he would block the $104 billion European Union aid package to Ukraine. Orbán had accused President Zelensky of Ukraine of refusing to repair the pipeline in order to help Orbán's opponent in upcoming elections. The election will apparently be so tight that Vice President Vance is being sent to Hungary in support of Orbán. Now the EU has stepped in, offering to finance the pipeline's repair if Orbán will vote to approve the aid to Ukraine. If Orbán is true to his promise, the EU offer will finally enable passage of the aid package. Cuba's president vows resistance to an attempt at a U.S. takeover. On March 18, Trump told reporters, quote, we'll be doing something with Cuba very soon. Whether I free it, take it, I think I could do anything I want with it. Those comments led Cuba's president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, to say Cuba will resist any U.S. attempt to take over the island. In the face of the worst scenario, Cuba is accompanied by a certainty. Any external aggressor will clash with an impregnable resistance, Díaz-Canel said. The Trump regime clearly isn't satisfied with the economic changes promised by Cuba, such as allowing Cuban exiles to invest in the island. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said, quote, Cuba has an economy that doesn't work and a political and governmental system that can't fix it. So they have to change dramatically. What they announced is not dramatic enough. It's not going to fix it. So they've got some big decisions to make over there. What Rubio is really saying is that nothing short of regime change will satisfy the U.S. And the U.S. is going after Colombia's president. The Trump administration has used drug trafficking charges to justify ousting Nicolas Maduro and bring charges against Cuban officials. Now they're doing the same thing with Colombia's president Gustavo Petro, accusing him of involvement in the cocaine trade. Trump has had an on-again, off-again relationship with Petro, on one hand engaging in angry exchanges over Maduro's kidnapping and U.S. gunboat diplomacy, and on the other having a cordial meeting in the White House. There is no mystery about this latest prosecutorial attempt. The aim is to remove another thorn in Trump's side. Petro's term in office ends in May, and replace him with a leader who will kowtow to Trump. It is Trump's preferred alternative to outright regime change, but in effect, the strategy amounts to the same thing. Next, Middle East countries and movements face difficult choices during Trump's war. Iran and Qatar accused Israel of attacking South Pars, the Iranian part of a giant offshore natural gas field that the two countries share. Gas exports are a critical part of Qatar's economy. Oil and natural gas prices are soaring as Israeli and Iranian attacks on energy facilities continue. President Trump said the United States and Qatar were not involved in the attacks, but The Guardian interviewed three Israeli officials who said the U.S. helped coordinate them. Trump has threatened to destroy Iran's portion of the gas field, vowing in a social media post that, quote, no more attacks will be made by Israel on South Pars unless Iran attacked Qatar's energy facilities. If that happened, he said, the U.S. would massively blow up the oil field. The Saudis, meantime, seem to be losing patience with the war as Iran's missiles have hit their country. The Saudi foreign minister said the 2023 accord that China brokered between Saudi Arabia and Iran had been, quote, completely shattered. But does that mean that the Saudis will act on their own, as the minister implied on March 19 when he said, we will not shy away from protecting our country and our economic resources? Evidently not. The Times is reporting that, quote, in a series of conversations over the last week, Prince Mohammed bin Salman has conveyed to Mr. Trump that he must press toward the destruction of Iran's hardline government, arguing that the U.S. attacks are a, quote, historic opportunity to get rid of a major threat to the Persian Gulf. That view contrasts directly with Saudi Arabia's public statements that it wants a peaceful resolution to the conflict as soon as possible. Hamas is said to be in a quandary as Iran, its principal arms supporter, sends missiles into Qatar, Hamas's main economic support. Hamas has straddled a fence, announcing support for Iranian resistance to the U.S. while also indicating concern about Qatar's security. Hezbollah's alliance with Iran is costing its support in Lebanon as Israel continues air and ground operations in areas once left untouched. The Lebanese government and many people there blame Hezbollah for the destruction it has attracted from Israel. Israel is taking full advantage, with the far right envisioning an expansion of Israel's border with Lebanon and settlement of Israelis there. Finally, Denmark faces a national election with national security first in mind. Danes will be going to the polls with a new perspective on politics, one in which domestic security is national security. As writers for Bloomberg report, quote, the highly unusual nature of the March 24 ballot is one in which security and Denmark's place in an increasing